a commodity worth more than oil, and it's barely been tapped at all in Maine. Pure maple syrup, the product of nature and hard-working sugaring experts all over the Northeast, is a precious commodity. It takes a lot of sap to produce a jar of syrup. Advancements in technology have made the process more efficient, and while some smaller-scale producers stick with more traditional methods, large-scale operations can bring a lot of syrup to the market. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll explore the business and the process of making maple syrup and collecting sap. Maybe you have trees on your property that can be tapped, and they don't necessarily have to be rock maple. We'll also discuss what climate change means for the delicate combination of temperatures that are required to produce the ingredients for syrup. Tapping into a popular New England staple, pure maple syrup. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. 30 years ago, Maine held the first in the nation statewide Sugar House event. Today, Maple Sundays of one kind or another take place throughout New England and even in Ohio and beyond. Today we're going to learn about making maple syrup, how this long, long winter has affected sap runs, how maple syrup gets assigned a grade, and we'll learn something about Canada's Strategic Maple Syrup Reserve. Very ominous sounding. With me in the studio today is Catherine Hopkins. She's a maple syrup expert and extension professor with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. On the line with us from Lake Placid is Mike Farrell. He's the director of Cornell's Maple Research Field Station and the author of The Sugarmaker's Companion. And joining us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio is Doug Wynot. He's an author whose latest book is The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. And of course, we want to hear from you, as always. Are you a fan of maple syrup? A tree tapper, perhaps? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Kathy Hopkins, we'll start with you. Welcome to Maine Calling, first of all.
Thank you, Keith.
As we just learned, this Maine Maple Sunday is an event that began a while ago, but it seems to have grown in popularity as I assess it based on my view from it, which is usually far down a back road trying to get to the event. What's going on with this popularity of Maple Sunday?
Well, I think it's been going on for 30 years here in Maine, so that has led to its importance. And it's an event that, when it was thought up 30 years ago, it was a way to get people out of the house after a long winter. And people seem to really enjoy that. They like going out. They like tromping down a muddy road. They like going to the sugar house. They like seeing the steam rising from the sugar house, and they like to sample some of the maple treats that they generally find at any sugar house. And so it's become a tradition amongst many families.
And of course we think of, or I do anyway, coming of age in the 1960s, I still think of Vermont as, you know, sort of owning the bragging rights or the branding rights to pure maple syrup. How is Maine doing in its quest to become a player?
Well, Maine has been increasing its production over the last couple of years, and actually they had if you take just the last 2 years, they've had the biggest increase in the number of producers of any state. And so I think people are interested in a lot of things. They're interested in local food and supporting local farmers and the natural aspect of maple syrup, and they want to make their own and they want to buy from their farmers that they know locally. So it's led to an increase in both producers and production.
Doug Wynot, you're joining us from New Hampshire, which also has a robust industry in it. Your book, you followed one Bruce Bascom of Acworth, New Hampshire. Why is he an important person in the sugaring saga of northern New England?
Well, he knows everyone. That's one reason he's important. He's been doing this all of his life. He He is the his company is the largest producer of maple syrup in New Hampshire. They make a quarter of all the syrup made in New Hampshire. And he's one of the largest processors of maple syrup, if not the largest processor in the United States. He buys a lot of syrup from Maine. It's produced in Somerset County, very close to the Canadian border. And most of it is made by French-Canadian producers who have sugar bushes in Maine, and they rent them from the timber companies and produce a lot of syrup. It makes Somerset County, Maine, the largest producing county for maple syrup in the United States.
Oh, there's a bragging right that I did not know about. Now, Bruce Bascom is also kind of interesting in that he, unlike his father from whom he kind of inherited this business, he took a different tack, going to business school instead of ag school, and sort of focused on the business side.
Yeah, he went to the business school at the University of New Hampshire, and he came back with more of a profit-minded mentality toward the business. But his senior project in a course in entrepreneurial management was to design a sugar house with 25,000 taps, all on plastic tubing, with all of the tubing feeding into the sugar house. It was kind of a new idea. He didn't discover this. He had visited some other sugar makers who were using plastic tubing. But this was his idea when he came home from college in 1972. His father was using buckets then. He was hanging about 7,000 buckets, making maybe 1,500 gallons of syrup a year. But Bruce began to develop a tubing system that within a few years was the largest in New England, possibly. And he was also possibly the largest maple syrup producer in New England after about 10 years.
Mike Farrell, tell us a little bit about, if you could, the history of sugaring in this country. Did this was a practice that began with the native peoples?
Oh, sure. They were doing it here long before the settlers arrived. But just as they taught the settlers a lot about sugaring, the settlers quickly taught them as well and was able to bring new technology from the European continent, especially the metal pots and the spouts and the buckets. It made things much easier. So the Native Americans had been doing it successfully with pretty primitive technology, and it's amazing how much they were able to produce given how they were doing it. And so they first taught the settlers how to do it, but the settlers quickly improved on those methods. And, you know, by the middle of the 1800s, we were producing the most maple syrup, actually maple sugar, here in the U.S. than we ever have. In fact, we produced much more back in the 1800s than we do today.
That's right. Doug Wynot, you mentioned briefly in your book that, maple sugar, the commodity, actually reached its peak around the time of the Civil War. What were the reasons for that?
Well, I think the maple sugar was produced as a staple in households. The dry maple sugar was a commodity that was traded widely, and from what I understand, the producers didn't really turn to making maple syrup until after the Civil War in response to the tariff being removed on white sugar and as a result of not being able to compete with white sugar in the market. So the syrup part of the marketing grew later on in the 18th, into the 19th century and into the 20th century. But Bruce still talks about his grandfathers carrying dry sugar on a wagon to the train station in Bellows Falls, Vermont, in the early 1900s.
And, of course, we have all kinds of different sweeteners on the market now, including artificial sweeteners that are used. Kathy Hopkins in the Mrs. Butterworths and those sorts of products. And you're making a face, as all good sugaring enthusiasts do. But still, the market, most of the consumer market goes for the Mrs. Butterworth's as opposed to pure maple sugar? Is that a matter of price or taste?
Well, I think part of it might be price, but part of it also is that maple production is kind of limited to northeastern North America, and so there are large parts of the United States that have never tasted real maple syrup or maple sugar, and so they're unaware maybe of how much different maple syrup, true maple syrup, really is. And one of the things that we would like people to understand, if they're going to choose to consume a sweetener, which dietitians tell us we should be reducing our sweet consumption, but if you are going to consume a sweetener, maple syrup or maple sugar has the highest amount of nutrients in it of any sweetener, and so you can get a little nutritional kick by consuming maple sugar as opposed to any of the other sugars.
And Mike Farrell, you write about the fact that there are other sort of natural consumables in not only sugar maples, but in other trees as well, for example, sap, that offer nutrition that we don't really take advantage of as much as we might?
Well, sure. I mean, maples aren't the only trees that you can tap for sap and syrup production. The other ones that we do here in North America are any species of birch or walnut trees. So, you know, here in New England and Maine, it's a lot of paper birch and yellow birch, a little bit of black birch. And the walnut trees are a little more scarce this part of the world, but we have butternut and black walnut. And so there's not nearly as many people tapping these trees. This is more of a small niche thing, but there's great opportunities with tapping these as well.
And what are you? You're not
more you're, people doing it.
Yeah, but you're not tapping them to make syrup. You're just tapping them for the sap.
Oh no, for both. Well, birch sap. The birch trees primarily are tapped for sap throughout the world. In the rest of the. Rest of the world, in Europe, in Scandinavia, Russia, and the Far East, they have a lot of birch trees. And rather than boiling the sap down into syrup, they use all of it for a beverage. They might drink it straight from the tree, or they might add sugar to it and some type of preservatives to be able to keep it for year-round use. But it's a traditional spring tonic, just like we do here to a limited extent. And you can also do with maple sap. So,
and there's a lot of commercial interest now in using maple sap to make health drinks or beverages that would be available year-round. So,
And Kathy, how many untapped sugar maples are there? I'm thinking, we talk about Maine's industry and wanting to grow it. Is it not just a question of going out and finding a bunch of sugar maples and tapping them? And wouldn't that be that simple?
It is. Sort of that simple. We have the trees. Every state in all of northeastern North America has enough trees to make a lot more syrup. But any industry is not a single, there's not a single strand that binds an industry together. You've got to have the trees, which we all have. You have to have market development, which we all need to work on. You need consumers if you're going to produce something. Without the consumers, then, there's no point in making something.
And Doug, why not? In fact, there is this thing called the Federation north of the border, which sounds very ominous, something out of Star Wars, which really does, though, control this commodity in a considerable production market in Quebec. Can you explain what the Federation is and how it operates?
Well, the Federation is an agricultural union in Quebec, the Federation of Quebec, the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers. There are about 7,400 members, or maybe a few more now. Quebec produces 70% to 80% of the world crop of maple syrup. In 2002, a marketing order was established in which all people buying bulk maple syrup in Quebec had to route it through the Federation. They can't buy directly from the farmers. And they also established a surplus that year. They established the strategic reserve, as they call it, to have a supply of maple syrup available in the event of a shortage. 2 years later, they established quotas because the surplus had grown so large. It was very controversial. Because Quebec and the Federation, because they produce so much syrup and because they're so organized, they set the world price for maple syrup. The setting of that world price has also stabilized the industry, and it has ironically allowed for expansion in the United States.
And anyone can jump in on this. Is there a bit of a Cadillac effect on this? That is, we get used to the idea that, oh, maple syrup is so hard to make, it takes so much sap, that therefore this little container is $22. It's a very precious commodity. We use it sparingly on our pancakes rather than, you know, squirting half the bottle of Mrs. Butterworth's on it. Is there an effect that has on consumers that makes them more willing to see this as a delicacy and pay more for it and sustain the market a little bit that way? Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think that people don't understand that you can use syrup for more than just putting on pancakes or ice cream. And almost every maple-producing state now has put out a maple cookbook with ideas on how to use maple syrup from appetizers to desserts. So getting people to understand that it's not just for that once-in-a-while pancake or French toast breakfast. You can use it for many different applications.
And Mike Farrell, there are different grades, if you will, which I'm sort of semi-familiar with, but it's not all one syrup. There's sort of the cream of the crop and then lesser grades as you go down. Outline for us quickly, if you could, kind of how that works.
Well, the current standard is that there's four grades, and the lighter syrups with the more delicate flavor are the grade A, and the darker syrups with the more robust flavor that you'd want to use for cooking, that's known some places as grade B or extra dark or extra dark for cooking. There's going to be a new international grading system that's going to standardize the grades from all the different states and provinces that'll kicking in some places now and other places later, but within a few years, everybody should be under the same grading. And the reason why we have this is because, you know, all maple syrup is a little different. And, you know, it's the lighter syrups you'd want to use for certain things, or some people might prefer the flavor of the lighter syrups, whereas the darker syrups with a stronger, more robust flavor are what you would typically want to use in cooking and as an ingredient. And as Kathy mentioned, you know, maple's not just for pancakes, and there's so many different things you can do with it. And so consumers can choose the grade of syrup that they want for the type of use that they're going to use it for.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to take your questions and calls, and we want to get into the science of this, why the sap flows, and also a little bit about climate change and what that means for the delicate balance of temperatures that is needed to make this natural and very tasty thing happen. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Husson University, offering graduate degree programs in counseling, human relations, and business. Information at husson.edu. And by Stevens Memorial Hospital, committed to providing quality care with integrity, compassion, accountability, respect, and excellence to patients in Western Maine.
It isn't easy finding good gluten-free breads, cakes, and cookies. So by popular demand, the cooks at America's Test Kitchen started experimenting to see if they could devise recipes that would taste as good as the wheat versions. Their favorite gluten-free recipes are in their new gluten-free cookbook. We'll talk with the editors Jack Bishop and Julia Collin-Davison on the next Fresh Air.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7.
I was changing jobs, moving from one place to another, and I no longer needed the car to commute. So finding out that we could take this jalopy and actually use it as an extension of, you know, wait, don't tell me, car talk, you know, morning edition, all these things that are a real part of my life, is a feel-good moment.
My name is Matthew Lowenbrown. I donated my 1998 Saturn SC2 to public radio.
For more information, visit mpbn.net and click on the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program button in the top left corner.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Making Maple Syrup. With me in the studio, maple syrup expert and UMaine Cooperative Extension Professor Kathy Hopkins. On the line with us from Lake Placid is Mike Farrell, director of Cornell's Maple Research Field Station and the author of The Sugarmaker's Companion. And joining us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio is Doug Wynot, author of The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Kathy Hopkins, we know that it's the sugar maple is really the target of this operation, but as has been mentioned, other species can be used. In fact, other maples. What other maples can we use?
You can use any maple syrup species to make maple syrup, and in fact, in British Columbia, they use the big leaf maple to make syrup. But you can tap any maple tree, and you can make syrup from it.
It's just that the rock maple produces the best quality.
Well, generally, the sugar maple has the highest sweetness in the sap, so you have to boil it down for less time, which makes it much more efficient if you can get a nice sweet sugar maple tree. So with the others, you just need to boil longer to get because the sap is not as sweet.
And what is the tree doing at this time in the spring? Why is the sap flowing? What does sap do for the tree?
Well, the sap is flowing because it's preparing for spring. Maple trees are preparing for spring. When they have a response to temperature changes, and if it's 20 or so at night and goes up to 40 or 45 during the day, that's a signal to them that it's time to prepare for spring. And they start converting some of their stored starch to sugar to send it to buds, so they're going to make leaves for the new coming season. And it's when that happens that we tap the tree to get that sugar out of it. As soon as the buds start to swell in the spring, the sugar is kind of reconverted to starch, and the syrup is not really very tasty then. We call that buddy syrup.
So there's a window here of opportunity that you have to tap the tree. And tapping is in its simplest form, simply cutting a shallow hole in the tree. And how would you do it?
Yeah, well, you get a nice sharp drill bit that's the same size as whatever tap spile you're using, and you drill a hole straight into the tree. Clean it out if you need to with a little twig. You tap lightly the tap into the tree, and if the temperatures are right, the sap starts flowing right out. And you can collect it either in a bucket or in a tubing system, and you boil that sap down until it gets 66 bricks, which is a sugar concentration, and then it's stable, and you can enjoy maple syrup.
Doug, why not? You tell the story in your book, I think, of how tappers were very persnickety about the size of the tap and the hole, and that it actually made a certain sound if it was done properly.
Well, that was something that Deb Rhodes told me about tapping. She's been doing it for about 40 years, and she's got her own technique. And she would say that three taps was just about right to drive the spout into the hole correctly. And when I was out there with the tapping crew, and there were maybe four or five of them working in the woods, when they were all drilling their holes and doing this and driving these tapping spouts, which are hollow, there was kind of a ring in the air, kind of a rhythm and ring in the air that was kind of nice to listen to. Can I add one thing about the flavor discussion that we were talking about, or the flavor of taste of maple syrup?
Sure.
And that is, I'll say it quickly, that maple flavor is iconic. The maple flavor is the only flavor that is produced in North America, that's native to North America, that I know of. I've been asking around about this. It is an distinct, iconic flavor that the you mentioned Mrs. Butterworth and Aunt Jemima and Vermont Maid. The artificial industry has come as close as they can to reproducing this flavor without actually calling it maple. That's an $18 billion industry. The world maple industry is $500 to $600 million. But, you know, you mentioned the price of that jug of maple syrup. It takes a lot of energy to produce it, a lot of work. But it's the real thing. It's a high-quality product, and the others are imitations that are coming as close as they can to imitating this iconic flavor.
Sure. And we can get back to this, too, and also calls. But, Mike Farrell, so we have – say we have the sap and whatever way we delivered it back to the sugar house. Well, what's the process then of turning that sap into syrup, and why does it take so much more sap to make a little syrup?
Well, it's only about 2% sugar, remember, the sap, and your final finished syrup is usually close to 67% sugar. So you're removing close to 40 gallons of sap for every gallon of syrup that you produce. And there's basically two ways of doing that. The traditional way is simply boiling it. You're just generating steam. That's why you see all the steam coming out of the sugar houses, out of the cupola. And everybody still does that to some extent, but the large producers and the using the most efficient technologies now actually remove most of the water with reverse osmosis before it's boiled. So basically high-pressure pumps pumping that raw sap against a membrane that can separate the water from the sugars. And so you can take out, say, anywhere from 75 to 90% of the water out of the sap before you have to boil it. And that makes process much more efficient and cost-effective.
With more on reverse osmosis now, we'll go to listener Susan in Springfield. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you today?
Good,
great topic. Before I ask my question, I was going to give some home sugaring people a little piece of quick tidbit. Years ago when I started, I would bury my sap in a metal container in the snowbank. And I would take, and then it would be frozen around the edges with ice, and it would have crystallized ice in the middle. And I would sift that out of there, and to make sure that there wasn't a lot of sap in that, I to prove my point, I boiled down the ice, hoping that to see if there was any sugar in it, and it basically made the pot sticky. So ever since then, I would just discard the ice and strain the solid ice, and strain the crystallized ice. And it would cut down my boiling process a little bit. So if anybody's interested in doing that, I kind of, you know, did my own science experiment with that. So, I'm sure it's all individual, too. My point about reverse osmosis, I've heard rumor that, and I'm not sure you guys are the experts, but the reverse osmosis versus open boiling, that with the open boiling, the nutrients stay in the sap, and the reverse osmosis filters some of the nutrients out. Now, is that just a myth, or what's the scientific proof of that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mike Farrell, do you want to start?
I can start on that. The reverse osmosis, when it's working the way it's intended, just removes water. Now, if the membranes are designed a certain way or if they're starting to fail, you could have some of the minerals passing through in the water. But also remember that maple syrup is concentrating not just the sugar, but the minerals. And maple syrup has a high mineral concentration because it's concentrating all those minerals. In fact, the mineral concentration gets so high in maple syrup, whether it's produced with reverse osmosis or not, that some of those minerals, those nutrients, actually precipitate out. And that's what you wind up the sugar sand on the evaporators, is just the fact that there can only be so much minerals in concentration, in solution, in that syrup. So there is some concern people have to not use reverse osmosis for that. That's not the first time I've heard it, but I would caution people that it's not a real issue, and the cost and fuel savings from reverse osmosis, even if that were true, would greatly outcompete any potential lost nutrients, which I don't think occurs.
Yeah. Kathy, anything you wanted to add there? That's covered.
No, I think Mike did a good job on that. Okay. I think, you know, that the maple is also considered to be a green industry, and reducing fuel consumption by using ROs is a great way to save fuel.
Another listener asks on the issue of technology, what about vacuum systems, and do they take out too much tree sap? Kathy?
No, I think vacuum systems have been studied quite a bit, and they've been in use for a number of years. And it's a misconception that the vacuum system is sucking the sap out of the tree. It's just changing the atmospheric pressure in the tubing so that the sap, it just kind of falls out of the tree more easily.
Encouraged to come out.
Yeah.
Let's go to Ike in Warren. Hi, Ike. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Your previous caller with an observation about ice answered one of my questions. So from now on, I'll discard my ice.
Okay.
The other is, which is the better fuel, poplar or pine? I have an abundance of both, but would like to get the most bang for the buck.
Panelists, any thought for Ike?
I'd say pine because it burns very hot.
I think whatever is easiest for you to acquire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the poplar doesn't have much creosote either, so it's also good. Both of those are excellent. They both have nice hot fires. That is what you want for your evaporator.
All right. Ike, thanks for calling. Let's go to Mount Vernon and Lewis. Hi, Lewis.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Go ahead, please.
Well, I have a comment and a question. I'll give you the question first. There's a technique that you can freeze your sap initially and then defrost it and pour off a certain percentage and then refreeze that and do it several times and then finally boil, and you only have a small amount to have to boil off. And I was just wondering, is there any, do your experts know of any commercial operation where that is technique is used rather than the osmosis or any other system?
I don't really know of any big commercial operation that does that, mostly because of the size equipment you would need to freeze that volume of
sap.
It's
an energy question also, of using that much energy? Or?
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, it would require a lot of energy to do the freeze concentration, and the practicality of doing it on a large scale. No, there's no sugar maker in the U.S. or Canada that's doing it that way on a large scale. One of our first callers who did it with the ice in the buckets, that's a great way to do it on a small scale. Throwing out the ice out of your buckets and your collection tanks is an excellent way to do it.
Right. The way I did it was I put it in my freezer and, you know, froze it and then defrosted a certain portion of it and then took that and froze it again and, you know, several stages and then finally boiled it down.
Yeah, and you want to do that final boil down, because it's not just the reduction of water that makes the maple syrup, the flavor, that iconic maple flavor that Doug described earlier. Part of that flavor is developed during the boiling process. It's the caramelization of those sugars under heat that gives you that maple flavor we all love. So reverse osmosis or freeze concentration, that's all well and good. Is a great way to remove water before the boiling, but you always have to do the final process there.
And Lewis, did you have a comment before we go to break?
Yes. When I moved to my house in 75, I only had a couple of sugar maples here, but I had a lot of red maples, and I had box elder. And I haven't heard in your show talk about using box elders. I read that you could use silver maple or red maple, so I thought, well, you could use box elder too, so it's the same genus. And I used it, and it produced fine maple syrup. It wasn't as distinctively mapley, and it was a very light color, like a very light-colored beer. But it was quite successful, and I would do it again, but I lost most of my box elders.
Box elder, another one
it's
for the
list,
Kathy.
Another maple species, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Northeast Delta Dental, administering dental benefits for businesses of all size in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Details online at nedelta.com.
More and more elite students want to work for tech companies and startups, which leaves Wall Street a little bit short on recruits.
Many of them are getting excited by the opportunity to disrupt industries and create new enterprises that may create thousands of jobs.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wall Street is fighting for talent. We'll have that story and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APN.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30. And join us at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for It's Your World. Today's speaker, Kenneth Roth, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, who reflects on the progress of the global human rights movement and shares his insights on the challenges and opportunities ahead. That's It's Your World, coming up at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, all about maple syrup. With me in the studio, maple syrup expert and UMaine Cooperative Extension Professor Kathy Hopkins. Joining from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio is Doug Wynot, author of The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. And on the line with us from Lake Placid is Mike Farrell, director of Cornell's Maple Research Field Station and the author of The Sugarmaker's Companion. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go down east to East Machias and Chris. Hi, Chris. Hi, Chris.
My comment is on the cooking end. I wholeheartedly agree that maple syrup is for more than pancakes. I make an avocado salad, and I use maple syrup. Swan's honey, balsamic vinaigrette, olive oil, and a very small drop of what I call thermonuclear sauce. I also include dates, and it makes for a very unique flavor. Thank you very much.
All right. Sounds delicious.
Sounds great.
We also, via email, hello, I was recently given some maple syrup, the best by date, 3/2014. How critical is that date? Does maple syrup go bad?
Maple syrup doesn't really go bad if it's produced and it's produced to the correct density, and especially in glass containers, it will last forever. The plastic jugs tend to have a shorter lifespan.
Do you want to keep it refrigerated, or can you?
Yes, it's good to keep it refrigerated. Yes.
Of course, yeah. In my house, that means on the kitchen table. This winter, anyway. Let's go to Carol, who is calling from Monson.
That's right.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, but my mind is at West Branch Pond Camps in Township A, Range 12, just beyond Cocadjo. This time of year, we'd just be starting up Maple Ridge to tap the maple trees, the sugar maples, the big old ones, to make the maple syrup for our sporting camp. So I'm with you today. This is a wonderful program.
Well, glad you like it.
Wow. I just didn't want to get talking too long because it's fun for everyone to be able to participate. I wanted to mention a wonderful book, a real Bible for people who want to make just maybe even just a pint or two of syrup, because it is a very hard job to do. It gets you between winter and spring. It gives you something to do. The book is by Helen and Scott Nearing, and I'm almost positive the title is The Maple Sugar Book, but by, I guess, using a modern tool like, well, the computer, you can just type in about anything and get what you're looking for. Nearing is spelled N-E-A-R-I-N-G, Helen and Scott, and try Maple Sugar Book. I'm pretty sure that boy, anything you'd want to know on a small scale or a large scale is covered in that book. My son has it now, and he's probably out tapping at West Branch Pond.
All right, well, maybe he's listening.
That is a great book. The Nearings are famous for that and other works that they did. That was produced, though, in 1950, and a lot of the technologies and techniques have changed since then. Is a wonderful resource on the history of sugaring and a lot of the lore and the stories behind it. And anybody with any type of interest in maple sugaring or maple sugar, I'd highly recommend picking up a copy of it. It's really a fascinating work.
All right, Carol. Well, thank you, and enjoy the rest of the day.
And if you want new, more current information, I think if you go to any cooperative extension website in New England, you'll find plenty of the current research.
From email, Kit writes, I recently read about a new form of maple syrup production in Northern Woodlands magazine. Instead of tapping mature trees, rows of 2-inch saplings are connected to vacuum pumps and are capable of producing 10 times as much sap per acre, 40 gallons per acre of forest tapped from maybe 80 trees, as compared to 400 gallons an acre drawn from 6,000 saplings, all planted in orderly rows. Has anyone heard of this, and can they comment? Kathy?
Yes, this research is being done by the Proctor Maple Research Center in Vermont, and they're the ones that have kind of stumbled upon this new technology. It is still experimental. They're doing more work on it this year to see what the real potential of this might be. But it does have great potential. Imagine if everybody that had an acre out back put in that many trees and started producing syrup. That would be very interesting.
Let's go to Bodenham and Thomas. Hi, Thomas.
Yes. Hello. I am aware that individual trees can have much higher sugar content than others. And in fact, somewhere in my reading, I came across that the sweetest maple tree ever recorded, at least here in New England, was actually a red maple. And I don't know, something like, 18 to 1 or something ridiculous. But is there a tool that would allow me to enter a stand of natural seeded sugar maple saplings and puncture through the bark during sap season when sap is flowing and measure the sugar content of the tree, because it will be permanent for life, as I understand it, so that I can individually select for the sweetest trees in the stand and thin out to those, select for those.
Yeah,
you can take a tiny drill and get a drop of sap out of the tree and put it on a sap refractometer and measure the sweetness of the trees. And that's one way to...
Can you get a sap refractometer at Lowe's?
Probably not.
Yeah, Mike Farrell, did you want to add something?
The same thing as Kathy with the refractometer. Also, you should note that there's been ongoing long-term research, started with the Forest Service back in the 50s and 60s, looking at what we call the sweet tree program. And the sweetest trees that we've ever tested, and we manage a lot of the sweet tree orchards now, and the highest sugar concentration I've ever tested was just over 10%, which means it would only take 8 gallons of that sap to make a gallon of syrup. I drink a lot of sap, and I could not even begin to drink that. It was way too sweet. That is an anomaly. So even with the sweet trees, our research found that on average, the offspring of these sweet trees were 30% higher sugar content. So you would get either 30% more syrup from these trees, or you would reduce your boiling costs and time by 30%. But, you know, going into those young stands, testing for sweetness, that's a great idea. If you have the time and inclination to do that, because there is tremendous genetic variation between the sugar contents of different individuals. And if you can select for that early when you're thinning out your stand, you'll wind up with a sweeter plantation or sweeter orchard of maples later on.
Great. We'll try to answer some more of these questions coming in. But Doug Wynot, I did want to visit, as promised, this issue of climate change. How is the industry looking at climate change in this part of the world, and what is it anticipating in terms of what its effects might be in coming years on this industry?
According to some of the federal climate change reports, the average yearly temperature has increased by 2 degrees since 1970. And according to some of the projections, that if emissions continue to increase at the present rates, by the end of the century, we could have a 6 to 8 degree increase in average yearly temperatures. If that's the case, the climate of New Hampshire could resemble the climate of North Carolina. This was stated in the New Hampshire Climate Action Report in 2009. And there have been other climate change reports that have stated this, that if this continues by the end of the century, the maple syrup industry will only be viable in the northernmost parts of this country.
And in Canada.
And in Canada.
Yes. Where it's already doing pretty well, as I understand it.
Yeah, they had a very tough year in 2012, too. It got very hot up there. In 2012, we had the warmest March in history, and there were 10 days during this heat wave when it didn't freeze. And the sugar season shut down right in the middle of March in a lot of different places. Commercial sugar makers can keep producing and keep harvesting sap during those warm periods if they have good vacuum systems, good tubing and vacuum systems, because the holes don't dry up in the same way. But this can be a this could possibly be a serious problem for the maple syrup industry in future years.
And of course, there are, you know, just weather wise, there are every winter is different, and you never know what's coming. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to gauge for most of us against the backdrop of that ebb and flow of temperatures, this overall slow change that's coming.
Right. Yeah. I think in the short term, the climate change will add chaos to the system. And for example, the last couple of years, we had very early seasons. We were tapping in at the end of January and making syrup in February. And now, this year, we're back to sort of a normal time frame for tapping, and there really hasn't been much syrup produced yet this year. So the season probably will go well into April at this point.
It's quite a flux there from January to April.
Yes.
Let's go to Lincolnville and Barbara. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, hello. For several years during the aughts, I was on the Cooperative Extension Executive Committee in Waldo County. And at one point during that time, I learned that a large percentage of our sap harvested in the state is sent out of state for processing. It's like the lobsters going to the Canadian Maritimes for processing. What are we lacking in the state? A large commercial boilers or what? I mean, there's a lot of $20 quarts of syrup being sold under a New Hampshire or Vermont label rather than a Maine label.
Kathy?
Well, I think that's a misunderstanding there. Sap is not sent out of the state for processing. Just because of because hauling that much sap around is prohibitive. So it is boiled down into syrup in this state. A lot of our syrup is bulk sold to big processors out of state. Most states have strict laws regarding the origin of food in terms of how it's labeled. So it may be some of the syrup that's made in Maine may be sent out of state to big processor packers. It may reappear in the state as product of New England. It may be packed out of state and returned as product of Maine, even.
So more like milk than lobster?
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Barbara, thanks so much for calling. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to bring in as many calls as I can. To Barrington, New Hampshire, and John. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Got a quick question. I've just been doing this kind of out of a few red maples in my front yard for a couple of years now, and I've always found, and I just boil it down on my wood stove, you know, which I heat with anyway, and I find that the syrup I get doesn't seem as flavorful. I just wondered, you mentioned earlier about the high heat needed for the caramelization to get the real mapley flavor. Is that something that I am missing out on by just doing it on the wood stove, which doesn't get all that hot, but
Mike?
That's probably part of it. And also I'm imagining you keep everything nice and clean and process that sap right away. So you don't have any chance for the sucrose to convert into some of that glucose and fructose that will caramelize at a lower temperature and give you that strong, dark maple that you might be thinking of as you know, as the maple flavor. You know, there's all different types of maple flavor. I'm sure your syrup that you're making is a delicious light amber.
That's certainly good.
Maybe notes of vanilla.
It doesn't seem as mapley as the commercial stuff I've been getting.
Well,
right.
And the other thing is that if you're making your syrup from a small sample of trees, they may be individuals that just don't produce a lot of that maple flavor. And so, you know, maybe it just doesn't taste as mapley as syrup that you get from some other region.
I've also heard that the flavor of red maples is not as good as sugar maples.
Liz asks, can you tap the dreaded Norway maple, Acer plantanoides?
You can tap it, but we'd rather you just cut them down since okay. They're an invasive species.
Ah, okay. And with that, we're out of time. Thank you all so much for being here. Interesting conversation. We learned a lot.
Thank you.
Kathy Hopkins, maple syrup expert and extension professor with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Doug Wynot, the author of numerous books, his most recent, The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. And Mike Farrell is director of Cornell's Maple Research Field Station near Lake Placid, and he is also the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer Lucas Randall Owens answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcasts by visiting mpbn.net/mainecalling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. Don't forget that on March 27th, that's 1 week from today, the Maine Calling Book Club returns with a discussion of Monica Wood's memoir, When We Were the Kennedys. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.